Direct from the edge of the lunatic fringe, it's the Raleigh James Show.
Friday night, the time is right for trivia. We will get to that next hour, I promise, but this hour is going to be a joy. We'll be talking to the world's tallest midget. I kid you not. Actually, I was thinking of a way to introduce Gary Allen if for some reason you were not aware of him. And you'd have to be pretty young to not be aware of him if you're a real Top 40 fan or, as far as that goes, radio in general. But if that's you, as I was looking around, I found some wonderful links to air checks that turned out not to be there, which is always frustrating as all get out. But then I found his induction into the Texas Radio Hall of Fame.
Hey there, this is Mark Carrillo. If you can't come up with a good idea, you can always steal one. That was the mantra of many a program director who went on to make big bucks and big names for themselves for decades, borrowing the brilliance of Gary Allen. If you've ever wondered just who came up with Hi-Lo, Win It Weekends, Cash Call, and Don't Say Hello, it was Gary. He got his start in radio in the 1950s in Ohio, made it to Miami, even Atlanta. But it was Uncle Sam who sent Gary to Texas and Fort Hood, and a short time later to San Antonio during the Cuban Missile Crisis. He moved up the ladder to eventually become chief specialist of the 4th Army's radio TV operation, replacing another person of note, Private First Class Steve McQueen. In his off time, he worked at KITE, and shortly before his honorable discharge, created the persona of the world's tallest midget and became the night host at KONO. Management saw his potential and first promoted him to music director, then program director. And under his leadership, KONO became the biggest radio property in the Alamo City. It was 1968 when he left San Antonio and on to lead other radio properties to prominence in cities like San Diego, Denver, Seattle, Washington, D.C., and Kansas City. But Gary maintains still today, Texas radio was the best he ever heard or ever worked in. He is a true radio renaissance man, largely responsible for the second golden era of broadcasting. Gary desperately wanted to accept this award in person, but a family obligation has him back home in Los Angeles. He offers his sincerest thanks to his many colleagues and the tremendous talent that have allowed him induction to the 2013 Texas Radio Hall of Fame.
And that isn't even the half of it, and I am thrilled that nothing has stopped Gary Allen from joining us tonight. So hello, Gary.
Hello, Raleigh. Good to talk to you again. Oh, my apologies to anybody that wrote that song.
No, that's great.
How are you doing, honey? It's so good talking to you again.
Oh, likewise. Likewise. You know, I was so frustrated because I wanted to play some of the air checks that were on Real Radio, and I couldn't manage to get them. So then when I was looking around, I found that induction. I said, well, that's just perfect. We can start there. Do you really think Texas radio was the best you ever heard?
It was among them, I think, the most exciting.
Yeah.
It's hard to say. You know, when you're in the moment at a particular place, you think it's the best. But when you look back on it all, it was one of the more fun radio places I think I ever worked with San Antonio. I got to work there twice. I liked it so much.
It's a great city, and of course it has a wonderful musical heritage, all those West Side sounds that I crave so much.
Oh,
yes,
gosh.
Sonny Azuna and everybody else. And
Talk to Me. Yeah. That was one of his things.
Well,
and, of course, Doug Somm, Sir Douglas, he's
yes,
from there.
Yes,
yeah.
Demas Garza, and many others. There was that guy who owned the restaurant who produce this stuff, and on the one hand, I loved the fact that he loved this music, but it was all so horribly produced that I had very mixed emotions about that. So,
well, yeah,
Yeah, you didn't start there, though, of course. And one thing that I noticed, it's the 31st of May, and I know where I was 60 years ago, and I don't know if you were. I was going through the spoils of the second annual disc jockey convention at the Americana Hotel, and you were in Miami. Did you go to that convention?
I was there.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I
yes.
sure was.
Absolutely. So.
Yeah, that was 59, wasn't it?
Yes. 60 yeah. years ago right now, the 28th through the 31st.
Oh, you're right. You're absolutely right. You're
yeah.
right.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, I was working, so we couldn't have as much fun, only in our off time, to get to see everybody and things at the time. So, yeah, it was fun nonetheless. It was one of the more incredible events and conventions, I think, I was, because, well, that's at the... It set the mark for all the rest of them. You know?
Right, right. Well, it actually stopped them cold for a while,
as, it did.
Yeah, to say the least. But yeah, I remember the first thing I noticed was ABC had bought all the cabs in the city, and it was free cab rides if you just said you were a
yeah.
disc jockey. And on and on the yeah. events. But as you know, since you were there, it was supposed to have a kind of a shadow of respectability, and so it was that the governor of Tennessee was there to speak, and of course, Pat Boone. Mm-hmm. And Randy Wood had the Goodyear blimp welcoming everybody to town.
And yes, it was, can you top this, all over the place.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Now, were you at WAHR at the time?
Yeah, we were. You see, yeah, that's right. I would have been there. That was, we changed the call letter, so it was WMET.
Right.
And so I was just there as they changed the call letters.
All right. Now, did Alan Rosenson still own it when it was MET?
Oh, see. No, he did not.
Okay, so he sold.
And then it was bought shortly after I was there, too, yeah.
Right. Right, and then the frequency swap and the creation of 790 and all that kind of stuff. But that was
mm-hmm.
That was very exciting radio, and you worked alongside with a total unknown, Larry King, and many.
Well, he wasn't totally unknown, but he was down there. He was
yeah.
big stuff. He was. Yeah.
Yeah, he was starting to become big stuff, but you know, of course, later who would have ever guessed? If you had to pick anybody you worked with there, would you have guessed that the national name was going to be Larry King?
No, you wouldn't have. You
yeah.
wouldn't have. There was others that might you thought might have been. There was Bob Green, who married
yeah.
Anita Bryant, I
right.
think, and maybe
yes.
we thought big things were going to happen with him, but it it really didn't. Outside of Miami, nothing really happened.
No, absolutely. In fact, he met Anita Bryant at that convention.
Oh, is that right? Now I didn't know that.
Yeah.
That's,
yeah, and
see, live and learn. The longer you live, the more you learn. That's
yeah.
it.
She was on Carlton back then, and they brought her in to
yes.
shake some hands and all that. And Bob Green, of course, was on WINZ.
INZ,
yeah, which was top 40 for a moment, and
yeah.
not for very long. And Mike Joseph was their consultant. And
yeah, they were good. They had good power, and they had a beautiful studio. It overlooked the city, and it was a beautiful place.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. There are so many stations across the country that had just gorgeous vantage points, and it was rare that those were the stations that sounded as good on the air.
Yeah, that's true. It's those in the hole in the wall.
Yeah.
It's amazing what you can create out of nothing, you know?
Well,
I was pretty good at it at times.
You've done that repeatedly. So you started out at Wing and Dayton, which one of my favorite areas, because
yeah.
I just love Cincinnati radio. And I know you
yeah.
do, too. You were, what, SAI, ZIP, and CPO?
Yeah, and a couple of different times, not at the same time. But, you know, I started out, I came down there to go back to college because I started at Wing when I was just 17. And a half,
wow.
and got a lucky break, and so I decided I needed to go back and learn some more. But I went to work at a daytime station, and they would give me nights that I had classes, and so I was still only maybe 18 or so. So why not give it a try? And so I did that for a while.
I just always thought that Cincy was one of those markets where disc jockeys and television personalities, of course, could be local stars. There was just adulation
yes.
for that. The only other market I know, two, would be Pittsburgh and Buffalo. But I'm sure
yes.
when you were there, you were quite the celeb.
Well, you were when you were on the air, and we had, well, Wally Phillips started out of WLW before he ever went to Chicago.
Right.
And he was really big, and he was on television as well, and he was really big in Cincinnati, and the town really missed him when he up and left, I tell you that. But he was getting to be as big as Ruth Lyons was in Cincinnati, and she was really big.
Oh, yeah, the 50-50 club, there's, you know.
Yeah.
And when you think Cincinnati, you think Skyline Chili and Ruth Lyons. I mean, it almost stops right there.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. You're absolutely right. And WLW, of course, it's just one of those incredible stations that just happened once, you know, where they set the rules for you know, wattage on the air and how much you can have. And they, since they were, you know, owned by EFCO, and they could go in and make anything they wanted, they could... before the rules came in, and I think about the Communications Act of 34, I think, set the power standards, and they had to, you know, go all the way from 500,000 down to 50,000.
Yeah, yeah.
Clear channel, though.
And yeah. Kept that water-cooled transmitter and would fire it up once a week to just make sure that that 500,000 still worked, much to the consternation of every farmer in southern Ohio whose barn lights wouldn't go off when they were at the full 500,000.
Oh, I know. I know. And people could pick them up on their fences outside.
Yeah. Anything with a coil. Heaven
right.
forbid they had a convertible sofa. Now, when did you go to WSAI?
Let me see, 60. I think it was 1960.
Okay. That was exciting.
Yes, yeah. We had, and while I was there, I think Sherry Gordon owned it at the time,
mm-hmm.
and they had big personalities. And then Consolidated Sunray out of Philadelphia bought it, and they bought it from Sherry, and Sherry had a station here in San Diego, KSDO, which became the all-news station.
Right.
But Sherry was quite the broadcaster, and they had a great people on the air. They were all personalities that, you know.
Well, you had Ron Britton, right, about that time?
Ron was there. Ron, and he went on to Chicago.
Yeah.
And became much more famous, and... There was Ron Allen,
yeah.
But we had several. But the early people they had on, Will LeNay, he had been there a long time, and he was so popular that he broke his shows up. He did 3 hours in the morning, and then he came back to 3 hours in the middle of the day.
Wow.
And he loved being on the air, and the people just loved him. I don't know what the attraction was. He was good. Then he later came out here to Sherry Gordon's station and worked with them for a while out here at KSDO.
Now, you were at ZIP as well.
Yeah, that was across the river.
Yeah.
In Covington, yeah.
Yeah, the little station that could.
Yes, but didn't.
Right, yeah, but did, yeah. That's great, but didn't. Well, well put. Now, in addition to WMET, you were at WHAMMY. Now, was that when Frank Ward was programming it?
Yes, Frank. Frank and I worked together at SAI when Consolidated Sunray bought it.
Mm-hmm.
And he, as you remember, if you saw him, he was like 6'6",
right,
tall guy and big guy. And he came up with the idea of standing up doing your show. And we had lavalier mics that you had around your neck. And he had the turntables and everything elevated, and the control room board and everything elevated. But unfortunately, they were to his size, and somebody as short as I was, it was kind of tough to get there, but we made it. But it was tough getting used to. You always sat down doing a show, and now here you were, you had this freedom to walk around and talk at the same time, and it was hard getting used to doing that.
Oh, sure. And then later it became so standard.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah,
now,
it did.
When you were at WHAMMY, that was a very different time than when you came back a decade later to Miami when WMYQ was on the air. Did you follow Al Casey as program director there? At MYQ?
At which station?
At MYQ?
Yeah, no. You know, I'm trying to think who it was. because they were in between. And George Wilson, who was the president of Bartell at the time, he asked me to come in there and say, just try to keep the station afloat.
Right.
Because they had gotten in a little FCC trouble. I don't think it was Al Casey, though.
He was the first. So, yeah, he was earlier than the Greg Austin debacle. So
Yeah, there were several debacles there.
Yeah, yeah, which and, ultimately led to the frequency going dark for a while.
Yeah, and they did. And they had a lot of ex-employees and disc jockeys who would work there and then go across and work for the competition, Y100 or whoever it was.
Right.
And tell them all the secrets. And so you had to do a lot of changing. And then they knew how to get to our power box on the outside of the building in the alley and back of the station. So a lot of times at night, and it was hotter than blazes down there a lot of times in the summertime, of course, all the time. And when that air conditioning went off, and they would come by there, drive by, and jump out and drop down the handle on the fuse box, and everything went dark.
And
it took us, you know, many minutes to get back up and running on the air. And that was something you could always get, you could never get used to that, you know.
Oh, hell no. And, of course, that building wasn't well built for that, and the studios were on the second floor, and then there was an elevator that didn't work when the power went out, so it was just a joy to get down.
I know, and I remember the disc jockey was on the air, and I forget who it was, but he was just sitting in there with his shorts. He had his pants off.
Oh, no.
I mean, there was no air conditioning, and it was just awful in there, just awful.
Now, you were in Denver at KIM.
Yeah. And 65.
And, you know, I mentioned before about some stations that that looked beautiful but didn't sound it, and others that were hell holes. And KIM was in the hell hole variety. And what was interesting about that is they finally got Showplace Studios, and they went to hell in a handbasket.
I don't know what that is. I thought our station there wasn't all that bad. I mean, you walk in the front, and you could see the disc jockey on the air. They had the double pane glass where you could sit and watch the guy if you wanted to. And I didn't think it was all that bad. The station was clean, and it ran like a Swiss watch. It was just perfect all the time. I mean, you know, it was one fine station.
It was on and off the air. You're right.
Oh yeah.
Now, I gotta ask, I've always heard it associated with you, but where did the world's tallest midget come about?
Well, that came about in Miami when I was down there at MET, WMET.
Okay.
And we had a jock there who was a funny guy, Pat O'Neill.
Sure.
Later went to New York, but he hit me with that one time. He said, coming on next is the world's tallest midget, and it kind of stuck. And I liked it.
Yeah, it's great.
And then it was fine until I came out to KCBQ the first time, and Mr. Bartell came in, and he was really about 5'4", 5'5".
Oh, no.
And he didn't quite like the world's tallest midget. He thought I might be offending midgets, you know, and short people. And so we had a little discussion about that, and he said, and so we came up with the leader of the little people. So we tried that for a while.
Oh, no. That's worse.
Yeah. That's, I think so, too.
Absolutely worse. Well, which Bartell brother was that?
Oh, that was Gerald Bartell.
Okay. Yeah, because they sort of took turns running the place, which is fascinating to think that they had any success at all. But as a chain, they most certainly did.
No, I'm sorry. I said Gerald was the other brother. Lee is the one that ran this station.
Okay, Lee. All right. Yeah.
Yeah, well, and then Gerald, and then Rosa. She was the sister, and they all kind of, every year or so, would become the president.
Right,
you know?
Right, would alternate. There were two other brothers who blessedly didn't get in the action, but I think it was a total family of five or something from Milwaukee. And I'd never known anywhere else where literally the clock changed, the year changed, and another brother shows up, you know. So that's...
Oh, I know. And Lee he sunk himself pretty deep into San Diego, even though he stayed, he kind of have this time between here and New York, because they did have all the Bartell publishing back there they had to contend with. And so he had a he bought a lot of property down in Mission Valley, which is when you could buy land for next to nothing, and now it's $1 million an acre if it's anything.
Oh, of course.
And he's got a hotel down there. He had and he had a home, and he had everything going. You know, that he was a lawyer besides. You know,
mm-hmm.
but he hadn't been busy in the law business though for a lot of years.
Yeah, it's interesting how many people in California got fabulously wealthy just by virtue of they bought land when it was cheap. And I don't think a one of them thought it was going to turn out the way it did.
No, they sure didn't. I remember when I first came here later on in 65, I think it was. And they, down in Mission Valley there, which is it's like Hotel Row, but they had cows grazing.
Right.
There's pastures, you know. They had barely completed the freeway through there, Interstate 8. And, it was almost like going right into farm country there for a moment or two, you know, except there was a couple, so that was it, yeah.
You know, it's so funny. When you were first working in the 50s and the early 60s, there were so many different owners. And, half of them we would just have very negative things to say about. And you look at it now, and the worst of them is more creative and better than the best of them today.
Oh, I know. And especially the Kim in Denver. I mean, Palmer, the general manager there, he knew everything about radio from engineering right on through. I remember the first day I was on the air, he came in, and I came out of a record, and he was standing right behind me, and all of a sudden, $500 bills flowed down in front of me on the console in front of me, and I said, well, hold on a minute. I said, the general manager is here, and he just gave me $500. He said, yeah, so we wanted to welcome you to Denver, and we wanted you to quickly come up to the contest and give it away. And so, I mean, it was phenomenal what he was. He was an amazing man. He really knew his stuff.
Yeah, Ken Palmer.
They were a fine company.
He was respected by everybody. I never mm-hmm. heard a bad word about the guy.
No.
On the other hand, at Kono, you were working for Jack Roth. And, and of course, you were WPLO, which I, to this day, laugh when I think about Plow and Harold Krellstein. That had to be interesting, working for him.
Well, it was, because their headquarters was at Memphis. And so they we would get the logs for the next day sent in advance, a day ahead of time,
mm-hmm.
for the next day. And we were to write down everything we were going to say and talk about. And then those all got shipped back to him. Plus, he would air check the stations from wherever he was. He could listen. And so he would then compare your notes that you wrote on the log with what you actually did on the air. And if they didn't mesh up too well, he would call you in and want to know why. You know, I had never encountered anything like that. You know?
Yeah, before or since. Well, it fits, because no. Here's a guy who tried to copyright the term Top 40. And I always thought that took a lot, considering he had nothing to do with inventing it or coining it.
No.
But Plow decided that they were going to own it. Clearly it didn't work out, but that fits so well with what you're describing. But, you know, when I look at those days, and admittedly, the late 50s, early 60s, those are my radio years. That's what captured me every way, shape, and form. And here,
I think we're only 39,
well, that's
I don't
right.
understand that.
I don't either.
Yeah. Yeah,
absolutely. But what was interesting, of course, is as time went on and the music changed, obviously, and the times mm-hmm. changed. And, you know, I didn't change along with them. I remember I was working at an unknown FM station in they said they were going underground, and I swear to God, Gary, I thought they were moving. I thought, oh, we're moving. And so, but most
of them in the subway.
That's right. I thought, yeah, okay, we'll go to the basement. That won't be bad. But most of us who come from that era, the last thing we wanted to do was work in progressive rock or any of that. I didn't want to hear it. I didn't want to listen to it. When I did hear it, it was for the most part, horrible because there was virtually no creativity because everybody was too hip for the room. And all the things that had worked so well in Top 40, they just weren't going to touch.
Yeah.
And here you come in the early 70s, and you basically recreate your own Chicken Man, which was as Top 40 as it gets, on an album rock station, and San Diego is talking about that to this day.
Yeah, they still do. It's amazing. I don't know. There's a few of them still alive. Yeah, but no, we had no idea. We didn't have enough money to subscribe to the reading services they wanted, and so we'd get by hearsay from other radio stations how well we were doing. But a lot of people thought at the time Richard Nixon had something to do with it. It was a pirate radio station operating off the coast. Honest to God, they did. And we were downtown on the wharf there.
Well, it was an X station, though. You were you did have that kind of cachet of broadcasting from Mexico.
Yeah, we did. And we got away with some things we couldn't have gotten away with over here as far as a little bit of language and things like that. But it was the first semi-automated cassette station. We'd had reel-to-reel, and some people had tried it in conjunction with cartridge machines. But this is the first time that Paul Schaefer, the guy who invented Schaefer automation, he came up with this automated tape cassettes. And you know how slow they run, about 1/7
yes.
inches per second.
Yes.
And so They worked as long as we have to send those across to Tijuana every day. A guy would come across and who spoke no English, basically. We had a little shoebox, and we'd put the next day's music cassettes and commercials and a log, and away they go. So Tijuana Power, at least then, was a little unstable at times, so it could go on or off at any time. And so, one time we were listening we had like 10 decks, I think tape decks for cassette decks, and you could have put this radio station in a closet, honest to God, and it would trigger one another. But every hour they had operadores down there. They had operators who would change the cassettes from hour to hour whenever they needed changing. So the music deck, number one, we figured out one of them was running very slow.
Oh, no.
Could barely understand what the song that was on. It was going so slow until it would get into the next decks that had music in them. So we kept calling down there and calling. I remember Neil Ross. He knew a little Spanish, and he called down this number, and somebody, picked up the phone, and he said, Máquina número uno es despacio, which meant slow, is running slow.
Right.
And this person kept saying, ¿qué? What? And he said, Máquina número uno es despacio. ¿Qué? And finally she put somebody on the air, someone who could speak a little English, and we told him it is number one machine. It was running slow. And he said, I don't know what you're talking about. We've gotten a taco stand down in Tijuana on a
corner
somewhere.
That's great.
He didn't know what we were talking about.
Now, I have actually a couple of the episodes of the OB Ranger, and you, of course, we've got to do this. There's just no reason not to. You, of course, were the Ranger. And from what I understand, Neil Ross was just about everything else.
Yeah, except Miss Mellons, who turned out to be Lee Marable, who came to work for us.
Perfect.
She'd had a little radio experience, but mainly in traffic, and she was desperately trying to get into radio and become one of the few females that anybody would let on the air. So,
well, it's
and
a
she
fine
was very
start.
Good, though.
Yeah, fine start.
Yeah, she was excellent, and she's still doing a lot of commercial work today.
Yeah, her name comes up fairly often.
From out of a cave at the foot of Sunset Cliffs, the thundering hoofbeats pound with a hearty hi-yo, Sylvia, away! The OB Ranger rides again. The OB Ranger and his trusty sidekick, Indian, riding his swift Pinto named Ford, embark on another moon-like mission, raiding the dwellings of Ocean Beach in search of illegal and nefarious goings-on. We join our trusty troopers walking to Ranger Chief Gustapo's office.
Now, here we are at Chief Gustapo's office. I hope he has an important assignment. I'm scratching to go.
Itching, Kimosabe, itching.
Well, scratch yourself, Indian.
Well, if it isn't the odd couple, what do you two want?
We've come to rape with Chief Gustapo.
What you said, shamey, shamey.
Obi mean rap with Chief?
Well, I never, using that kind of language in front of a lady. Hold your tongue.
All right, can we go in to see Chief Gustapo's office now?
All right, garbage mouth, go in.
Call out, Goofy, and out of sight, Chief.
Ranger, what's the matter with you? Are you on something?
No, you see, I'm holding
better
my...
Better let me explain, Chief. Miss Melons, tell Kimo Sabe to hold tongue.
I see. Okay, Ranger, you can stop holding your tongue now. You might bite your trigger finger off.
Thanks, Chief.
All right, now listen up. Our intelligence reports tell us that no-good Panama Red is working out of the Long Branch Saloon. And he's hiring henchmen to enlarge his illegal goings-on in Ocean Beach.
Hiring hunchbacks, eh?
Henchmen! Henchmen! And I want you two to get right down there pronto and put a stop to it. Comprendez-vous?
Yes, Chief, but I don't understand.
You don't even know how much a whole lot of nines are. Now get.
Hey-o, Sylvia, hooray!
Meanwhile, at the Long Branch Saloon...
Send in the new hired gunman. The man.
Howdy, Panama! What's up, man?
Well, if it isn't La Jesus Manos, the most notorious gunfighter south of the border. Long time no seeds, man.
No stems either!
Hey, listen, Lave, I've hired you to wipe out the OB Ranger, our main stumbling blockhead, block to busting this town wide open, you dig?
The OB Ranger, eh? Ha ha ha! I'll shoot him so full of holes, he'll think it's a pin cushion.
That's good. Now listen, man. Dig the plan. I want you to engage the Ranger in a showdown.
Well, it sounds like high noon in Ocean Beach. The Ranger and Indian en route to the Long Branch Saloon and that awful guy, Panama Red, hiring the notorious gunfighter La Jesus Manos to do the duo in. Will the Ranger pass the bar exam or will he end up in Boot Hill? Don't miss the next grave episode of the OB Ranger.
Which is hilarious, and more so when you think this is in the middle of album rock music. So,
yes, right.
Yeah, that's the part that for most people would just not compute. And, of course, it made so much sense because your all-cassette automation didn't allow for a lot of personality interaction, to say the least.
Yeah, we decided to make the station a personality, kind of make it stand out. Once you put on commercials and things like that in the early going, but I tried to get the Chicken Man, you know. I tried to get them to spring for some money. No, we don't have any money right now. You guys are clever. You guys can come up with something. And that's how we came up with the OB, of course, for those who are not familiar, stood for Ocean Beach, which is where, and to this day, most of the so-called head community live, and the dopers, so to speak. Yeah. They're still down there. But that's where it all started, and was what the OB stood for, and the Ranger, and Chief Gustapo, and all that other stuff. We just took off from there, you know.
No, it was great. And again, if I didn't know and you said who ran that, I'd say, well, probably KCBQ, because it sounds about as top 40 as you can get. And I was always entranced that the album rock community just loved the heck out of this. And like I say, you see every now and then a blurb in one of the newspapers or magazines or, you know, whatever, that fondly remembers every one of these episodes. Now, the last I had read, which is over a decade ago, you were going to put the whole thing out on vinyl. Well, maybe not vinyl, but CD, but a compilation for folks to buy.
Yes, we did do that. I had a lot of that, I think as I told you when we spoke last, that I was part of a fire, one of the California fires here, and I was one of 70 homes that got burnt to the ground out of the 200 that are here. And so a third of this place got burnt to the ground, and with it came went all of my my things like that. I still think there was one fellow that dug them off for me, and I think he has most of them, and we're in the process now of trying to see what is available. We called out some that had just local connotations, local mayor's races or things like that that wouldn't have any, nobody would know what we're talking about. So we came up with, out of the 90-some episodes that we did, we came up with about 55 of the best, and so we're going to put them out, Volume 1, 2, and 3, and I got Volume 1 out, and so I did sell that and get those out quite a bit, and we did sell the Ranger episodes on a couple of radio stations, one in Hawaii, I think, and somewhere else, a couple other places, but that was the main thrust of it, and it was, but we tried to not make it too local. I remember once looking in Billboard and saw that it was a breakout album in Buffalo, New York. And to this day, I can't understand why people, they had a sort of an underground type station there, and they put it on the air there off of the album. And it was cut a little bit differently than our episodes were, because when you played that episode there, that was episode one. The next hour, we would play the capper to it, or part two.
Right.
We did a few four-parters, but mainly there were two-parters. And so we would play those just on the weekend when we first started on the air on his. And so 1 hour would be the first episode, the premise, and then the conclusion would be the next hour. So we try to get them to, and then maybe 3 or 4 hours later, we do it again. And throughout the weekend like that.
I know.
And that's how that all came.
Yeah, I know why you would think that Buffalo was an odd choice, given it is in no way reminiscent of San Diego. But it is such a great personality radio town that I could see people glomming on. In fact, that's where Frank Ward was before you worked with him in Miami.
You're absolutely right. I was going to mention that, because the Buffalo jocks were some of the best jocks I ever heard.
Yeah.
They were not screamers.
No.
But they were tight as, Jesus, tight as you could be on the air. But they all had that wonderful, soft-spoken voice.
Yeah.
And they all just, they moved it, you know. And hit cues like you wouldn't believe, and they used the count system, and they did all of that stuff that just used to knock me out. And I worked with a couple more. Happy Hopkins was one. And then Tom Clay, I got to work with him a couple of times, and to me, he was the best of them all. He was sensational.
He was sensational. You betcha. And so many people came from Buffalo. Of course, Joey Reynolds still at it to this day. Amazing.
Yeah, it's amazing, isn't it?
But that tip sheet that came out of there, Mickey Turntable, which we all read.
That's right. Yeah.
That was George Lorenz, you don't think about Buffalo as a haven of soul, but he certainly was playing.
He was the hound dog or something, wasn't he?
Yes,
was he the hound dog?
Absolutely right. George Hound Dog Lorenz, And I guess Mickey was George's secretary, and they named it Mickey Turntable, and that went on for years. So
yeah, well, that's when I worked at WFM. It was owned by the Wyszetyskis, as a Polish name, which I don't ask me to spell. They later changed it to Wilson, of all things, and made it more English sounding. So, but they bought FUN and put it on the air, and they were terrific when they went on the air. And Sid Knight and Fred Hall was another one. He was excellent. They had a great staff down there.
Now, that's interesting, because I thought that FUN was put on by Rounsville in that three-way slot, so that he had MBM, and then they created that 790 and that 800 went away, and that 1220 and that 1490.
They came in after that. They came in afterwards, and then And then Jack Roth bought it.
Well, I thought Jack Roth bought 1260.
Well, he bought Whammy. He bought 1260.
Yeah, he bought...
Yeah, you're right. I'm sorry. You're right. I'm wrong.
And that was a very weird sale because he got the transmitter of Whammy and he kept the studios of Rise because he had that Rise at 1550, Rise to the right side of your dial, you know, where you had to go out in a boat to get to that damn tower. But, so he's a daytimer. Just so, you know, he had a chance to buy Whammy, and so he kept his studios in the Carlway Bank building, and I guess the Whammy studios went to Woody Sudbrink, who had wound up with had been Rise. So I think that's the way that worked.
Yeah.
But
Roundsville had some great radio stations.
Oh hell yes. And
I thought his stations they were excellent. And in fact I think Jim McCrell, he worked for one of those a long time ago as a jock and then later on as a newsman, and he later came out to LA and Hollywood and started becoming one of the game show hosts, and now he's back in Houston, retired, I think.
Yeah. Yeah, but no, he had some great, so he had DAE in Tampa, and of course, all the great soul stations that he had, like CAN and VOL in Nashville. You know, them, and you'll probably remember the OK group was the other soul group that would have BOK and LOK and all that. Yeah, just terrific stuff. But Roundsville was, you know, one of the early scrappers. He'd buy these stations that were, you know, for usually impoverished signal-wise and managed to move them up and sell them. But that was also the time when, and you'll remember this, before they put in the three-year rule, when people were buying stations and selling them before they even took them over. And it's funny because today that's business as usual, but back then it was so shocking they instituted the three-year rule. And so it was that, you know, I think the two guys in Minnesota, you never worked in Minnesota, did you?
No.
Yeah, you didn't miss much.
I kind of opted for the
warmer weather.
I don't know. I had a chance to go to Boston. I could have gone to Fort Wayne at Westinghouse.
Yeah.
I just couldn't bring my Cleveland. I did consult a station up there. I thought Cleveland was a great radio market at one time.
Yes.
They paid very well. St. Louis was another great radio market.
Oh, absolutely. Well, you know, as you know, when we're looking at radio 60 years ago, Cleveland is a top 10 market, you know. Same with Pittsburgh. I mean, Milwaukee was number 20. You look at it now, and the population has so shifted. But, yes, I did notice that trend, that you seem to like the southern markets when possible. And I don't blame you for that. But as they were saying in the Texas Radio Hall of Fame intro, you came up with a lot of stuff. Now, high-low, that's something I don't care where you listen to the radio. You heard
they
somebody. Oh, yeah. So where did you first do it?
You got me on that. Let's see. Where did I first do that? I'm trying to think. It was somewhere in that 53 era, and I can't recall where I was.
Okay.
I was in the service, but Atlanta, no.
Well,
I can't remember.
I understand.
Anyhow,
believe
so
me,
long
I relate
ago.
To that. Well, they're probably
and we did
again.
So many contests. In those days, we had a contest. Every jock had a contest, and we had one that was going on the air. Then we were promoting one that was about to come off. And so it was just contest all day long. It was just you were afraid to turn the station off because you might miss something. That's what's missing.
That's exactly right. That's the phrase I use all the time. You're afraid to turn off the radio for fear you'd miss something. And that was true.
Yeah.
And whether it was the contest or whether jocks could make you do that, Dave Hull in his heyday was very much like that, you know, when I'd listen to him.
I remember Dave Hull in the date.
Yes.
He did the show on WONE, I think it was.
Right, right. Exactly, Group One. And you literally were afraid to turn off the radio. It was wonderful stuff. Now, okay, don't say hello. And again, by the early 70s, I don't care where you were, saying, I listen, WMYQ plays less commercials, or I listen to the new sound of Y100. Yeah. So you were the original Don't Say Hello. Do you remember where you did that?
Well, I think Stan Richards and I both came up with that. I think it was 63 when I got out of the service, was getting out of the service, and he came from Cliff down to KONO. I think we came up with that. I think that's one.
Yeah.
And he had done something similar to that at Cliff, and we turned it around a little bit. And we did so many contests there, I can't begin to tell you how many. And Stan was one of the great programmers that I learned so much from Stan. His days at Cliff, and he had a chance to go to ABC in New York and turned it down.
Mm-hmm.
He loved Dallas, and his wife told him, she says, I can't take that cold weather. And so he turned it down, and then Gary, came in as Rick Starr. Came in.
Yeah. That's a shame, but we'll just leave that there. But he was actually much better off not going there, because ABC, no matter how you sliced it, was still a corporatocracy. And when you're dealing with a guy like a Jack Roth or a McClendon, it was much more by the seat of your pants radio, and it was more exciting and more fun, the things you can get away with.
It was. There was one time when I was at KONO. Nobody knew about it. Somebody got off a plane at the airport in San Antonio, and he started handing out money.
Mm-hmm.
And it caused a big row. It made all the UPI, made everybody had the teletype, and everybody was talking about it, KTSA, all the radio stations in San Antonio. And he should have waited a few more days, but really strung it out. But after about the third day, it came out that there was the KONO millionaire.
Right.
Because this guy he said that he'd come upon a small fortune and worked with the people of San Antonio. And so he started, and you had a phrase of the day, and if he stopped you on the street, you gave him the phrase of the day, he'd give you some money. But at the airport, all he gave away out there was a couple $100 bills and a couple $50 and $20. But that just made all the newspapers unbelievable. It went on for a month, and finally he said, too, that he wasn't giving away the money fast enough. And he'd come upon a secret location, and he was going to be giving clues and to be listening, and he'd have a phrase of the day. In the meantime, he'd be still handing out money. I remember one of the phrases was from diamond to diamond. It was one of them. But anyhow, so the day came where they were getting down to the last two or three clues. People had it kind of figured out. It was a lot, empty lot in a part of San Antonio, and it was about the size of a football field, something like that. And by the time we got there, we had this big Lincoln Continental or whatever it was. He was dressed in his outfit. I was trying to drive the car. And when we got there, there was only about a clue to go. And we said, the place was ringed in cars. I said, how are we going to get out there in the lot? And we had all this money wrapped, rolled up in KONO envelopes. Looked like cigarettes by the time you looked at them. They were rolled real tight with rubber bands around them, and we had about 500 of those. And so there was only like a dollar and some of them, and $5 and $10. And I think the whole promotion, we only spent about $1,200 or something like that. Ridiculous. And it went on for 6 weeks. And we finally found a place next to a fire hydrant that we could squeeze through. And people started, as we got out in the field, they saw us, and they came running, and we had to stop, and I says, I'm not driving anymore because I don't want to run over anybody.
Right.
And all of a sudden, the police came in a helicopter, and with their big bullhorn up there, said, we're calling this off in safety. And so we figured, now what do we do? And there was some lady got her leg fractured where the crowd ran right over, And so they later estimated the crowd at about 35,000. Can you imagine that?
Yes.
On a Sunday afternoon?
Absolutely. And, of course, thank God he did it the way he did, because prior to that, Gordon McLendon was having guys throw money out of windows in Dallas, causing traffic tie-ups. That was crazy. And, of course, the worst thing, and you probably worked at stations that did this, was people who buried the money. And, of course, Todd Storrs had to get the city of New Orleans a new library. And, you know, I think Gordon... Gordon had... go ahead. Go ahead.
Are you there?
Yeah.
No, I said Gordon also did that one where they put the money in the public library.
Yep.
And the people got in there and just tore all the books apart trying to find the money.
Exactly.
And they got called down severely about that one, and that's what caused the FCC to finally start regulating some of these contests. You couldn't do some of that stuff anymore.
Well, I remember the one that I associate with Gordon is he accidentally had all of El Paso dug up because he put the money on a lawn. And, and yes, the FCC went semi-crazy. And in fact, when Todd Storrs bought WQAM, he had to do so with a proviso that he not have a contest, period. And, of course, that went on for less than a year. And, of course, everybody else had a contest, and ultimately he did, too. It was interesting what they would do to get the public involved. And, as I say, serving the public interest is not the same as serving the interested public. And, unfortunately, in the case of this, there was a certain amount of destruction. But, fortunately... all was usually forgiven, but it was costly.
Well, do you remember that this guy did this at so many radio stations in the South, Chief Washakanoka?
Oh, yes.
Oh, God. He would be buried with snakes in this pit.
Right.
And people could come out and watch him in there, and then we'd check in every hour or half hour, whatever it was, and he would say, yes, things are going to get in the crowds building, and then hold on, I think I just got bit. And he'd hang up the phone, and they'd think, oh, my God, and more people would run out there and go and watch Chief poke over with all these snakes, that he was in this pit with. I never did understand that one, but he did this all over the South.
Yeah.
It was unbelievable.
They were like carny men, and it was like the traveling circus, and there were so many of this. And, of course, then radio stations did their own. How many disc jockeys have been buried, or how many disc jockeys have had to live in something that's, damn near high altitude? All the different...
I was buried in Kim and Denver in a mountain of Mountain Dew when Mountain Dew first came out.
Oh, no. Where? Where was this in Denver?
It was in a shopping center in a store, and they built this thing up real, and they had to have stairs to get up and look down in, and it looked farther down than it was because it was just a very small, maybe 5 or 6 inches wide, this tube, and I was laying underneath it, and you could roll out from under it and actually stand up. People couldn't see you do that.
Thank God.
But the thing was that it's when nature called, you did have a problem.
Yes.
And so late at night, you'd have to tug on something and have some. You would send up some of this material. It was the worst thing I ever was in my life. I was there 2.5 days, I think.
And what did somebody win for you being buried in a mountain of Mountain Dew?
Oh, don't ask me. I don't recall. It was something pretty good because Kim didn't do anything that was cheap.
Right.
Palmer would always say that. He says, we got these X amount of dollars behind us, millions of dollars behind us. There's nobody going to outspend us, so don't worry about anything. I mean, if somebody gave away a car, he'd give away two or three of them or a garage full of cars.
Right.
You were never going to tell Palmer this one.
Well, right, and he could do it with class. I loved the stations that had no budget and could do it, because I remember, spunky little WFUN, as you mentioned. QAM had given away cars, so FUN gave away garages. There were no cars in the garages, but they were garages. And some of those bits that people would do in response to budgets they didn't have, and you've worked a lot of those. I mean, you were at Casey with about a $30,000 a year budget. So tell me about some of the things that you pulled off.
Well, we did a seven-car giveaway. So we were the Magnificent Seven. We were at KONO. And we used to use promos with that bum-bum-bum-bum-bum-bum-bum-bum from the Magnificent Seven you know, soundtrack. And so, yeah, we were in Kono country, and it, we made it sound so expansive and deep. it was just amazing. But we told them they were going to give away. And we had television, too. We could put promos on over there. Then we had the dance time thing that we did, swing time, that was called on Saturdays. We preceded Dick Clark on Saturday morning, mm-hmm. And so we could promote it there too. But we gave away seven cars in seven garages, and there was one contest we did there out at this shopping center. Well, we put a big black box in there. It was 8 feet by 8 feet by 8 feet cube.
Right.
Had big question marks all over it, and they'd have to guess what was in it to win it. And so, the first caller on the air won it.
Oh no! Firstly, what was it?
Well, it was a sales contest. That's why it didn't work so well. But it was a trip to Hawaii, I think, a two in Hawaii or something like that.
How'd they put that in an 8 foot box?
I don't know. Just to confuse people, I think.
All right.
And so it was something. And then I think I told you the story about when I was at that ZIP VIP in Covington. The new owners came in and they wanted to make a splash. And so, they decided to give away this Esther Williams swimming pool. $5,000 swimming pool, which was a lot of money then. And so, and it turned out the winner lived in an apartment building.
Oh, no!
but it later turned out that it wasn't any such winner. It was really one of the guys who bought the station. Ed Weston and Len Gurian were the two guys. I forget which one of them, but they put that in the backyard of their own house. But made it sound like, and it was just a phony contest. And I hate to, but it was all false. Nobody won it but him.
That's hilarious. I remember those Esther Williams pools. They also had the Johnny Weissmuller model. And they were weird. They had some kind of vulcanized rubber on the surface. You know, it was just very bizarre. And
No, that was cheetah.
Yeah. Right. Yeah.
No, I don't know.
But I remembered they had those pools, and I'll be darned. Yeah, today even back then, if they were caught, that would have been loss of license. But you know, that's what's nice when you're WZIP. Nobody notices you're on the air.
Yeah. The thing is, we used to have people would catch on. You had the contest pros in every market. It seemed like where they would be the ones who would get in.
Right.
That's another thing about Kim in Denver, which impressed me. They had the engineers that built a cutoff switch right next to the phone, and so what that would do when you would hit the toggle switch to the left, it would send an electrical charge down the line and it would knock everybody off.
Mm-hmm.
And so, and if you said, caller number 18 or 12 or something, you had a pretty good chance of maybe not getting one of the pros, you know. That's the way I thought it was one of the cleverest things ever seen was that. And I used to tell other places, I said, can you do the same thing they did in Kim and Denver? And they look at you as what?
Oh,
the engineers didn't seem to know how to put that together. So, or another, you know.
That is good. I like that. I've known contest winners who would have multi phone lines and have plenty of recordings of dial tones so that they could be on hold on all the lines before the contest took place. And I was just thinking, wow, that would have defeated that. That's
brilliant. Well, we had a contest that Kim, when I first came on, just for me. To get me going too was, and you could enter as often as you liked. And it was a phrase, and we'd give a word to the phrase every hour for the week or something like that. but they were not, we tell them, not in any particular order. You had to figure out what the sentence was,
mm-hmm.
or the phrase was, and you could enter as often as you want. Well, one day this kid came in with a lawyer.
No.
And we wouldn't let him in. We had a big box, and he brought in something like 8,000 or 9,000. He'd run them off at his work and cut them. He'd get 10 or 20 to a page, and then he had a cutter that would cut them off into strips with just that phrase. And that's how he got so many of them. And so he brought in this whole box full of them, and it was his lawyer, and we wouldn't let him, but he could watch us through the window, the lobby window. So they were watching real close, and so I dumped all of those in on the day the winner was to be announced. And I thought, oh, God, I want to make sure he doesn't win. But I went in with my hand and mixed them all up.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm talking on the air, my hand went down for the last time, I thought I saw a yellow sheet of paper, piece of paper. And I said, let me hope I get that in my hand. And I thought I grabbed it. And anyhow, I went down deep in this big box of all these entries, and I pulled it back out. And by God, I did. I got somebody that wasn't this kid. And he stormed out of the station, and the lawyer huffed right after him.
Ah.
And they, at least we let him watch, but it was just strictly luck that I don't know, out of all of his 8,000 or 9,000, how I didn't get it. But that was, I was just hoping that was somebody else, and it turned out to be somebody else.
Do you remember what the prize was?
Oh, it was money, I think.
Well,
Palmer believed in. He thought there was. He thought there was nothing better than money.
He's right. Yes, of course.
Yeah, in those days, I remember doing bucks for breaks for Kramer. You know, people used to just jam the phone lines to win a buck.
Right.
You know.
Right. Great stuff.
And as soon as you read their name, they had to call up. But, you know, it was. But no, it was. You had contest pros in every market. They just. We'd get so upset when they didn't win.
Great stories. And we could go on for another couple hours, I think. But believe it or not, we've spent an hour together, Gary. And
I was just looking at the clock here, and you're asking, where did that hour go?
I know. And we haven't even touched the surface. So I will I will impose on you to do this again at some point.
Well, it's up to you, and I certainly do. Because I'm in that retirement age, you know.
Well, right.
So I'm
but, you know, I can hear it in your voice. You are still as with it as you ever were. And I know you're loaded with stories, and I haven't started to mine them. So we absolutely will do it again.
I just touched the surface, I think.
Yes.
Of radio stories.
Yes.
But anyhow, I hope the people enjoyed it, and I hope... we'll get to talk to him again real soon. I appreciate you letting me on tonight. I really do. It's great to reminisce with you.
Well, thank you for taking the time, and I promise we will do it again.